Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 261, my conversation with filmmaker Frankie Frain. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook and access to hundreds of books and podcasts, all included with your membership. Come on, get Audible. Yes But Why podcast is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is all about assisting people with their podcasts. My husband and I want to help you find the right podcasting path for you. Connect with us now at PodcastCadet.com. Use promo code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, I chat with Frankie Frain, award-winning filmmaker, YouTube content creator, and head of Red Cow Entertainment. Frankie talks to me all about his love for making movies. We also discuss technology, Lord of the Rings, and mac and cheese. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 261. Filmmaker Frankie Frain on telling stories and getting the job done. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
Like probably, you know, the earliest I can remember of when I felt some kind of creative drive or felt inspired to go create was probably like 6 or 7. I remember I had a Tandy computer my sister got it in 89, and you know, you could word process. And I remember I was reading like novelizations of sitcoms and like Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles and stuff. And I made my own Spiral Bound Power Rangers novelization, where, you know, you watch the show and then you transcribe the dialogue with the actions. And, you know, so I was in like second grade, and I remember being like really committed to the idea of completing it. I have a vivid memory of it being like a hot summer day, and there was other things to do besides finish a book no one was going to read. But I got really into, I think I was really attracted to the idea of a professionally made product of some kind, you know, something that wasn't only artwork, but something almost viable that could be consumed by somebody else. Because I think when you're growing up, you know, the first time you hear the word art or artwork, you're generally talking about macaroni pictures or drawings with crayons and that sort of thing. And this was like, oh, but with the computer, with the technology, I can produce something, you know, more developed. And so I remember that. And then I became aware, I think I had read a play, or probably not a screenplay, but something that was a format that showed like character dialogue and action between character dialogue. And so I wrote a few little things like that just to play with the idea. And then, you know, animation was interesting, right? Again, there was the technology component. I ended up, my career now is in technology. I'm an IT director for a college, but the technology aspect to it never went away. But if you skip forward in time, it was around the time I saw South Park, where I came to learn that these guys animated this show with construction paper. That captured my imagination, where it was, I was aware of what stop motion animation was, but it was like, yeah, but what if it was even cruder? What if it was, what if the barrier of entry was even lower, where you could actually, you know, just cut out some characters. And as long as it's funny, as long as it's interesting, as long as it's derived from real life in some way. So I started writing little scripts and doing animations in that construction paper style. And I remember now we're in like, you know, I'm like 11 or 12. And I'm, every time somebody says something funny, every time there's a serendipitous situation, I'm mentally cataloging it for like, oh, maybe I could factor that into a narrative somewhere. Like now nothing is going to waste all of a sudden. Like I start getting into that mode. And then, you know, exactly.
You're like a tiny child with like a joke notebook where you're all yeah. like, oh, yeah. that is funny.
Yeah. It was looking for scenarios, you know, like, or opportunities. I was learning about parody. And this is, you know, around the time of early internet where there was no YouTube, right? It wasn't like there was like this rich, vibrant, you know, world of people uploading. But there was like E-Bomb's world and there was some of this sort of subversive internet stuff. So, and then because of the South Park link, I became aware of the fact that Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of South Park, they had made a film in college. It was like their college thesis film. And so it was at a Blockbuster, strangely enough, even though it was like this very independently distributed, you know, Troma Studios put it out. And so I rented it. I was at a sleepover in eighth grade. And I said, hey guys, we all went out and we're supposed to like rent a movie. And I was like, let's rent this one called Cannibal the Musical. And like the mom was like, all right.
And we took it home. Like, all right. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she only saw the musical and not Cannibal. So we went home and we stayed up really late and we watched it on this old tube TV. You know, outside of the birth of my child, the meeting of my wife, you know, this is probably one of the most character defining moments of my life. We put on this VHS and it was this gory scene that started the movie, but it was comedic. It was like it was sort of like Monty Python, comic violence. And the TV we watched it on was tuned incorrectly. So the fake blood looked even faker. It was like bright orange, basically. And so it was like, and I remember all my friends were like cracking up at how stupid what they were seeing was, but also how, you know, it was a clever movie. It was a musical. It was a Rodgers and Hammerstein production on top of being, you know, like a Troma B movie. And so they all fell asleep mid film, and I, you know, it was almost cliche. Like I'm just like glued to the TV, not because I necessarily loved the movie, though I did, but more because it was the first time I can remember where I saw, it was very clear to me that the people that made this film had fun making it. Like I was seeing the production of the film in much more clarity than the film itself. And I thought, well, again, much like their animation, I was like, well, this is a low barrier of entry. This is something I've always talked about, which is, I think if you've had lots of conversations with creative people, often they pinpoint their moment of inspiration for when they found something that seemed doable. Like, you know, like musicians who found the Ramones or something are like, well, I can play a few chords. You know, it's rare that a filmmaker sees Stanley Kubrick movies and it's like, that's it. I could be a filmmaker too. You know, the barrier of entry is way too high. So, that was the biggie. And then that, you know, I never could draw or anything. That's part of why the crude animation was attractive. But all of a sudden this new thing was presented to me, which was like, you just need to take your funniest friends, you need to find some creative people at age 12 and get a camera. And, you know, and at this point, DV cam cameras were available for $200. I remember I did have a dishwashing job for a whole summer and I bought this little JVC camcorder, started making movies. And notably, it popped into my, because of this Cannibal movie, I was like, oh, I should make a feature length film. There's no such thing as a short film. I don't know what that is. I should make an hour, you know, I won't be a real human being until I've made an hour and a half long film. So that was my goal. And I wrote this, this movie called I Need to Lose 10 Pounds, which was also, it was a musical about a kid who wanted to lose weight. And it had all the kind of B movie signatures that I had, you know, and now at that time I started to become really interested in kind of, you know, like John Waters and, you know, sort of like grotesque, you know, movies of the 70s and 80s and stuff. And so I was kind of going in that direction. And for the next 6 years, from age 14 to 20, I worked on this I Need to Lose 10 Pounds feature film. And it was reviewed once by somebody as it's like the Lord of the Rings of high school board, you know, film kids. Like, this movie was, I got a lot of very reluctant people to come along for the ride with me. And it did take 6 years. And you see very visibly people going from basically prepubescent to college aged. I had this weird, I don't know. It was like, if I didn't finish this film, I was going to die. You know, this kind of irrational commitment to seeing the project out. And there were lots of times where, you know, key people that we had shot lots with were on the brink of dropping out. And I met my girlfriend who would become my wife at age 14. She ended up being a 15-year-old producer on the film, and she continues to produce my stuff to this day. And you know, she has so much to do with, you know, she's so enabling. Like, you know, I was like, I need like some fake dynamite or something. She'd stay up all night making the fake dynamite. I need a dummy that we can hit with the Suburban, with your dad's Suburban tomorrow. And she would stay up all night building the dummy with me. And it was so, like I said, character defining. I think I knew if you don't finish this movie, you're probably not going to make the next movie either. You know, like it was like a rite of passage. It was you've got to, for your own sense of self, you have to finish this thing.
That's the case for all of us. It makes sense. Also, it makes sense that like it's hard to make a feature length film, and you were making it up as you were going along, and like it takes adults with millions of dollars multiple years to make movies.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, 6 years. Very regular when you factor in all of the school you had to go to and other events right. You had that were taking up your time.
I remember thinking that because I went to film school, I remember thinking, oh my God, I have to finish this movie before I go to film school, because there's not going to be one undergrad film student there who hasn't completed a feature film. I completely invented that in my head.
Yeah.
And I remember freaking out about it, that like senior year was coming up and I hadn't finished the damn movie yet. But yeah, I mean, we shot and shot and shot and shot. I mean, it's worth saying that like it was not only ambitious to do the 90-minute thing, but it wasn't as though we wrote a screenplay that like it takes place in one room or there's only three people, or it was like it's like an adventure epic. It was like there's all kinds of things that happen in this movie, and the locations I secured, you know, I got a school bus for a day and we were left unsupervised with it. We shot in a beautiful chapel with swords and there were no adults around. And I look back at some of the behind the scenes stuff and I'm like, if 35-year-old me walked in on these 16-year-old kids doing what they're, I would be like, you're all going home. This is insane. But we just, I don't know, you know, once we had cars, and this will become relevant later, but I had a friend, this guy named John Hunt, and he's now my co-host on the most popular thing I do, this mac and cheese review show called Box Mac. And so he's kind of in some ways the flagship personality of our YouTube channel now, but he, at the time he was just a very technical guy that was also a musician. And so he was like, he was really the fuel that made me go from, oh, I think I'd really like to make a feature film to, hey, actually, maybe we could make a feature film. And so he's outside of my wife, he's probably one of the most important creative relationships I ever had. And I think you do need, normally like there's some combustion element, you know, there's some relationship that lights the whole thing, or maybe it just stays a PDF, or maybe it's never a PDF to begin with. I always say there's a lot of sad PDFs out there just sitting on computers, not getting made.
So many.
Yeah.
So many sad PDFs. So, you know, I want to ask you, you've mentioned that like the part right after when you were talking about how South Park had inspired you, you're talking about like putting these stories together and creating, you know, like, oh, I was thinking of this story. Oh, I heard this thing and I was like, oh, maybe I can use that in a screenplay. Where did you even get the like idea to write a story? Right. I mean, it seems, I feel like writing and creating the full picture has always been what you were destined to do. But
yeah.
It seems like your brain is definitely formulated for storytelling. You're like looking for stories. You're trying to figure out how to put things together, you know, like, where do you think the storytelling appeared in your life? Is it like, you know, your parents were like that, or you took a class, you had a, you know, English teacher that was like, hey, this is what story is, or how did it appear in your brain?
It's a great question. I don't know that I've really thought about it on that level before, but I think the common thread through everything I've done, you know, because I've done, in addition to filmmaking, podcasting, and obviously YouTube and everything else. And so it starts after a while, it's like, well, what are you feeding? And I think it's just a desire to express, you know, so I want to, I want to express something original. I want to say something that, that maybe somebody else hadn't said. And I do think my, certainly my dad, you know, he, it's funny. My dad is a one of a kind personality. He's a blue collar, South Coast, Eastern Massachusetts guy, certainly not an artist, but he would, you know, if he heard a joke or a one-liner or something on The Simpsons, or, and he wasn't even like a, you know, he wanted the televisions off for the most part, but if he heard something really clever, he would call a lot of attention to it. And he would say something like, who even thought of that? You know, it, so that, which would inspire me to go like, well, why couldn't I think of that? Like, you know, it was, you know, it really captured his imagination. And so I wanted to capture other people's imagination like that too. And I think like once I saw, when I, you know, when I was like a preteen and started seeing parodies, I think parodies and, you know, I'm something of an impersonator. I think that's to this day, when I hear a really good impersonation, one that completely reveals somebody's personality that otherwise you hadn't noticed, you know, like if there's a super good Bill Maher impersonation or something, like, oh my God, that's not only him, but that's also how he views himself. You know, it, like it unlocks something. I think it's something like that, but more than anything else, it's just some desire to express and to create. And I think anytime I, again, pre-internet, anytime there was like a behind the scenes special on TV or make your own, that's what started some of the filmmaking was there. I saw like an ad for like, ingest video into your computer, you know, take your computer and bring video into it and then manipulate the video. And there was just something about it. It was like, you can wait, what? Like I can take something that's linear and make it non-linear and do something, you know, I can mold it like clay. Like how does one learn this magic? And in 2000, you couldn't, there really was no consumer technology for that. I remember we actually found somebody online in the Adobe forums from Quebec who was selling like a capture card, and my dad reached out to him. My dad, who does, again, doesn't know what it means when his son says, I want to make a movie. He reached out to this guy and said, you know, my son wants to edit the video. And, is that something where I could just send you the computer? You could put it all together and then we'll come up to Montreal and you'll teach him how to edit the video. And then we'll go away. And we really did that. We showed up to this Canadian guy's house, you know, with his invitation, but it was a stranger online. And I stayed over their house overnight. My parents went off and enjoyed the time in Canada. And I learned how to edit video from a guy named Francois Dompierre. I've been trying to connect with Francois ever since. He's a super nice dude. But
I really thought that story was going to go a different way. Oh my God. No, I can't believe this guy taught you how to edit video.
Yeah.
And you
spent a weekend with them.
To Canada?
Yeah.
Guys,
yeah,
isn't Canada's that crazy? Not close. Canada's not like next door to where he lived. Okay. Like,
no, it was a 10 hour drive. Yeah.
10 hour drive.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. And you know what's good? I'll say this. There's a fan of ours because we do mac and cheese reviews. Wow. and Kraft Dinner's big up there. And there is a fan of ours who works in the film industry up there, and they all know each other. And he knows Francois. And he was like, I'm trying. Francois has not replied to my emails for some reason, but he's in reach. I would love to do a podcast with Francois Dompierre and be like, look at me now, Francois. Oh my God,
you totally.
But he did. That's what kicked me off was like, you know, it was an Adobe premiere that he showed me, but, wow. that was the start of it. Yeah.
That is amazing. God bless that man. Like, I can't believe he said yes. Like, right. I can't believe he did it. Like, that is so kind. And, like, how much does your dad love you? He drove 10 hours to bring you to Canada to learn how to edit movies. Like, oh, my God, right. That just, like, warms my... We were talking about parenting earlier from our own points of views. But, it like, now that I'm a parent, it, like, really... I'll literally think of things my parents did or said, and I'm like, oh, like I didn't get it at all in the moment. But now that I'm there, I'm like, oh yeah, that's why I shouldn't have done that. That's the thing.
And it is made all the sweeter by the fact that my dad just you know, it's not as though, like, you know, he's a thespian and was like, this is in the tradition of our family. Like, my dad was a fisherman. And
let me introduce you to Francois.
Yeah. Francois, you know. Yeah, it was nothing like that. It was like, I found a man who knows technology. Let's send him the computer and then let's send him you. That's what happened.
Let's send him you. Also, another hilarious idea about the idea of right now. Like, can you imagine? Oh, God, so
it would never happen. It would never happen. But it was.
I feel like we're going to be open to that in a minute. I mean, people have spent a lot of time with their kids. They're going to be like, what? He can go to Canada. Someone's going to teach him. Great. Whatever. Get him out. Go to Canada. Seems safe there.
Send him you.
Exactly. Send him you. Oh God, it's so great. And I love the idea that this man like taught you something and then like disappeared from your life. Who knows? Because like
He's
I
gone.
Have teachers like that too, where I cannot. I when I was a kid, my mom was a teacher and she started working like immediately after, you know, I was born. So like I was always with babysitters. And when I was 6 or 7, there was a nanny after school who took care of me and one other kid. And she legitimately taught me what theater was. Like we did plays and she showed us how she put us, we'd get in costumes, we would do shows for her and we built the sets and stuff. I would not be doing what I'm doing without her. And I can't find her anywhere. Like I found out, I was like, I know her, I called her Miss Blackwell. Well, nobody's missed for very long. So I'm like, dang it, I'm never gonna find a Blackwell. You know, I found out her first name from my mom, you know, I'm trying to find her. It's just like, there are people that we meet along the way that inspire us so much. And then there's just no way to thank them.
Yeah. You know, they're critical. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if somebody were to find you and be like, you have no idea the impact you had, wouldn't you be so thrilled to hear it? You know, and shocked and, you know,
I'm
going to
say thrilled, but you are also from Massachusetts. So, you know, as well as I do that I will be deeply embarrassed. During the entire conversation, I'd be like, no, what? No, I didn't do any of that. And then when she left, I'd be like, yeah, I'm pretty great.
Well, it is. I think it is the greatest compliment and probably the one that, like, if I were to want to leave any impression on anybody at all, it would be to inspire them to go create something of their own.
Yeah.
You know, that's the impression I'd like to leave.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, for instance, the like Sam Raimi and the Evil Dead stuff. I only watched that. I'm not a horror person at all, but I only watched it because somebody told me the story of like, oh, no, he made this with his friends in high school.
Right.
I was like, oh, yeah, all right, I'll watch that. Like, I don't care. But if you give me a solid, like, creative story of like, oh, this was made on a bus by two brothers and then they never spoke again. I'm like, let's watch that. That seems good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm more interested in the journey of like how it got made and like the experience of that than I am about any other level of, you know, oh, this one's really famous. People really like it. Never turns out to be the movie I like. The number one, the one that everyone will tell you to watch whenever I'm there's a movie on Facebook, everybody's like, oh yeah, super good, just watched it. I'll be like, I don't know if I'm ready for that one. But if you're like, listen, there was this one guy and he got a pig at a fair and then they made a movie with the pig and it's all about Africa. And you're like, what? Like,
yeah.
You know, that sounds very interesting. Let's watch it, you know?
No, I'm totally with you. I find myself rewatching making ofs, or you know, I mourn the loss of DVD really, because to me that was like a golden age of, you know, it was also during my formative years, but the ability to consume the movie and then all this supplemental material that acts as like a cool memorialized archive of the film, that was I had more fun making the DVDs for some of my films. And now I still do Blu-rays of our YouTube content just to, I don't know. I have like this irrational fear of like, well, if the internet ever goes down entirely, at least my daughter will have these or something.
At least this Blu-ray machine will still work.
Yeah, I know the hard drives of raw footage just ain't cutting it, you know?
There's like a woman carrying around a thumb drive in the apocalypse and she's like, I just need to look at this one thing.
There's no case or insert with a thumb drive, you know? Like, can't it just that it's just not a finished movie if it's on a thumb drive, that's for sure.
God, that's so funny. You know, I love that stuff too. I love the behind the scenes things. Like some of the apps, you know, have that kind of thing. Like Disney Plus, when they released Soul, the new movie that came out a couple months ago, they released it with all this behind the scenes footage. And it was great, because when a movie comes out right now, I want to be like, okay, when was it made? Was it made during 2020 or was it made previous? It was made previous. Great. I get it. Hope you guys had a nice time editing when you're at home. That sounds fun. But the idea of Soul, like, so one of the first behind the scenes with Soul is like what we did when COVID hit. And I was like, oh, this was mid-production. I'm watching this. Like, because I'm fascinated about the, you know, twists and turns of how people figured out what to do, where they were like, so everything in our lives are completely changed. And we need to continue to make this movie that turns out has to come out in a couple months. Can we do it?
Do you have Pixar animators, you know, with render farms in their living rooms and that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. No, well, they even talked about that. They like legitimately shipped their office computers to their homes. Like they like brought trucks and were like, okay, take this from your office, and like brought them their work computers to their homes. And I was like, well, good, because I bet you their home computers couldn't do what the office ones could,
right?
Pixar money, come on, let's do it. But it's so great. I love this idea of, you know, how it gets created and how it builds. Now, you mentioned both your wife and your co-host are people that you have continued to work with over the years. Do you have more people that are in that circle? Like, is it like the same crowd that you're making movies with over and over each time? Is it more of a community piece sometimes?
Yeah, that's extremely important to me, is like the family of it all. Some people, you know, I've known lots of filmmakers over the years, and some have spouses who are completely uninvolved, you know. In fact, in some ways, they couldn't imagine being like, you know, oh, I compartmentalize my art life, and my spouse doesn't cross over in it or something. Mm-hmm. And for me, the you know, especially when you're embarking on like a feature film or something, it's so all encompassing. It's so night and day, and what you're worried about and what you're involved with, that like to you know, it's a family affair. Now, I haven't made a feature since having my child. We do the YouTube stuff, but even the YouTube stuff is a family affair. So that first movie, I'll take you quickly through kind of the evolution of the family, you know, the creative family, what would become known as Red Cow Entertainment, which is our YouTube channel and our LLC for the, you know, the producers of all these features. The name was coined by John, my co-host. He got it from Newport Creamery, the restaurant out here. He loves the icon of the cow. And he said, well, we'll just make it red and it'll be Red Cow Entertainment. And I didn't want to come up with like a clever production company name anyway. So I was like, let's go with John's.
Why not?
So that first feature in a bit of creative poetry, it screened and won the Troma Dance Film Festival. Troma was the studio I mentioned earlier. They put out B movies like Cannibal, the musical, which I was inspired by, like, the Toxic Avenger and, you know, the Class of Newcomb High. They put out all these, again, like campy, grotesque B movies that have, you know, now they're doing like a big budget, remake with Peter Dinklage of the Toxic Avenger. But they had their own film festival out in at Sundance. It was like essentially across the block from the Sundance Film Festival. And I went out there and got to screen the movie and, you know, at age 20 and stuff, and see a reaction from strangers. I also four-walled it. I rented my own, you know, college auditorium back home and invited like 250 people and signed DVDs afterwards and did a Q&A and got to kind of like perform as like the local filmmaker. You know, me and my friends were all in like every newspaper for the screening and stuff. We really kind of like invented this mystique around us and the film. I remember my sister was in town. My sister doesn't live here. She was in town to see the movie. And I remember the guy at the gas station was like, are you going to go out and see that movie tonight? And she was like, oh yeah, my brother made that movie. It was this cool, I remember the auditorium we screened it in was this like kind of dank. They perform Rocky Horror Picture Show at that very auditorium. And so it was like everything about it felt like the creative vibe we were going for. And Trauma picked it up. They were going to distribute it on DVD, which was like my dream, and it never happened. They just signed it for 20 years and didn't, and they sat on it until recently. Now they have a streaming service, and it is on the streaming service Trauma Now. So it finally did release after all these years. That was going back to 2006 when that movie came out.
I was like, they were getting close to the 20 years, and they were like, listen, hold on.
Yeah.
Wait, before we give it to this guy and he actually makes money with it, let's put it right on this streaming service, and then we own it still.
Right. Right.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean,
great though,
you know,
that people can like watch it on a service and like it's there and like represented, right?
Yeah, no, it's a Trauma movie. There's no nudity in it or even gore, but it is a Trauma movie. It doesn't have any of the signatures of a Trauma movie, and yet it screams Trauma somehow with the humor and the amateurishness, but also sort of like the delusions of grandeur and stuff. It's very much a Trauma movie. So I was very excited. So yeah, I talked a lot about how 6 years went by of me just being like, I can't believe I'm not finished with this thing. I remember my family actually did try to intervene several times, and they were like, they're like, what about a short film, or what about maybe you just call it done now? And I'm like, no, it's not done until all these scenes are shot, you know. But I was really excited to do something else. I was so excited to, like, wouldn't it be great to make something else with a new creative team too, because the creative outside of my wife and John, you know, and some other friends who came, you know, who will kind of always be there. I had just started going to college in 2004. I went to Emerson College for film.
Oh, nice.
In Boston. And, I was meeting all these extremely creative, funny, way more talented than me people that I wanted to put into films. And there was a cinematographer named Doug Bergdorf, who's done very well on Vimeo since then. And he was my roommate, and he was willing to shoot something for me. And there's a couple of other guys who've gone on to become, you know, pretty big screenwriters and stuff. So I was like, let's make another movie. And the one I came up with, because I hadn't grown out of my camp phase yet, was this movie called Abo the Humonkey. It was about a half man, half ape, and the played by me. And we actually, you know, I got in contact with somebody who was from our area who was going to the Tom Savini School of Makeup in Pittsburgh. Wow. And it's so crazy because They had all of these, you know, like they had Hollywood talent teaching at this thing. Savini himself showed up all the time. They had the means to create prosthetics. They had talent, of course. They were regularly making, you know, mock-ups of the Predator and Jason and all this. Like, if you walk through the place, it's just like a museum of cool stuff that these students were doing. But what they were missing was there was no local film school. So there was nobody that wanted to make a movie near them. They just had like a solution without a problem. And so then in comes Trauma guy, you know, hey, my movie got distributed by Trauma, which, you know, of course is like saying like, I don't know. I won $50. You know, it's not that great of a thing to tell, but it was for them because they're like, oh, well, that's the Toxic Avenger and that's this, that, and the other. So I got this guy, his name is Mark Santos, Makeup Mark, and he created the prosthetic for Abo the Humonkey. And the conceit of the movie was that it was it was kind of like a parody of a family movie. It was like Jack or Forrest Gump or something like that, where you kind of impose the main character onto the audience and insist that, you know, despite his low IQ, he's lovable and deserves your affection and stuff. When in fact it's this creature that probably shouldn't have been born. You know, this is like genetic lab animal and stuff. But the movie is insisting that, like, you know, the musical score is very gentle and, you know, always implying that what you're watching is saccharine, but what you're watching is actually grotesque. So that was, you know, it was this high concept comedy. Some people really got into it, and some people were like, well, I'm not sure there was a joke in the movie.
They don't know what comedy is. I'm high concept for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is pretty high concept. But we had a blast making that. And that also screened at Troma Dance. And that was kind of the end of that. I went to Los Angeles right after that, thinking that I was going to try to start some kind of film career and that maybe my wife, who was a nurse, would come out and live with me.
Oh, like straight out of college to L.A.?
Yeah, well, Emerson has this Los Angeles program where they sort of foster that. So you're, if you're a film major, you're sort of supposed to graduate out there.
Oh.
You get an internship. I had an internship at 20th Century Fox, which was like, I actually got to hang out on the lot and go to table reads and all this. It was, although it was during the writer's strike of 2007. So they were actually coming. They were coming to the interns and asking for reality TV show ideas. And I had one. I said, what about a show called Stink Pot? And the concept is you've got to try to survive in society at your smelliest. And so, you know, so there's these challenges, like you go to the movies covered in garlic or something, and, you know, and if you lose your date or you lose your job or something like that, then of course you're voted off the island. You get pushed into a giant laundry machine or something, and you're off. And they were like, all right, we'll take Stink Pot under consideration. This is why there's a writer's guild.
When's the strike over?
Like, we're not paying him anything, right? God, no. So Los Angeles was not for me. It was the traffic is horrible. The this was right around the time YouTube was coming out, so there still wasn't, again, there wasn't like a really clear alternative for people who didn't want to work in the industry. There wasn't a clear, like, oh, if I want to exhibit work, I can just do it online and chat, and I'll probably find some kind of audience. There wasn't anything like that. So it was very disheartening to discover that it, you know, my Massachusetts sensibilities weren't compatible with Los Angeles sensibilities. And I really just, I wanted to go home and make films with people who loved me and people who had shown up to that point that they loved me enough to, like, you know, get into some really crazy situations and really commit a lot of their time to some, you know, to some really ludicrous movies. So I came back and I made a drama comedy called Sexually Frank, which did very well. It screened at the Sydney Underground Film Festival and it won their Director's Choice Award, and it went to the Cine King New York City Film Festival. We got to screen it at quite a few places. It's about, it was semi-autobiographical. It was about some of these people in my life that I really care about, and explored relationships, friendships, sexuality. It was shot in 2010, and I would say it was probably, you know, it wasn't straight up mumblecore, but it was of that era. It's a 2010 movie, you know. It's funny to think, like, 11 years ago that there was a type of movie, but there was. And
there's,
we made one of them.
Types 10 years later.
Yeah.
Like, I'm often telling people, listen, don't try to take in and understand what's happening right now. We will know when the Netflix documentary comes out.
Yeah,
that's
true.
They'll tell us what happened. We're like, oh, okay. Oh, that's why people were mad. Oh, okay. Sure,
right.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense. I get that. Man, yeah, I mean, I love the progression of your movies, like, so far that you've told me about, you know, because they're, I feel like you're working through your own, like, growing up as you're moving through this sort of thing. Like, you know, your first movie being, like, the wild high school movie made by a bunch of friends, classic. And also, like, if, as mentioned, you know, all these other filmmakers that we've both enjoyed who also made stuff in high school, and then you're like, oh, that's so cool. It is cool because it's this labor of love that's not like a studio putting money into something because it seems like it'll probably be a cash cow. It's like people who care making something and creating something. You know, one thing that's really struck me about your experience is that, like, it seems like now Emerson, great college. So, you know, post-college, clearly you've got some schooling. But, like, previous to college, you were doing these things without anyone having taught you. I mean, admittedly, all props to Francois with reference to the editing. But, like, the things, like, with the marketing, like, renting a theater and doing, and, like, even applying to a festival. Like, I didn't know there were festivals to apply to. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't even know there were internships I could have until I went to college. And somebody was like, No, actually, no, let's be real. I didn't know because somebody in my college told me. I knew because my uncle, who is an adult actor, was acting at the theater festival. And yeah. I was like, wait, that's a thing I could do? And he was like, yeah, you can. So, like, people aren't handing out this information. How did you know how to do any of this? Like, just from behind the scenes stuff, just from watching other people make it? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, DVDs were instructional for sure. I mean, you would... I think you would find a lot of filmmakers my age probably would talk a little bit about the those deluxe versions of the Lord of the Rings DVDs. You know, of course, those are $300 million movies. And I mentioned Lord of the Rings in jest earlier, but they Peter Jackson put out like, you know, three discs per movie of here was the post-production process. Here was the pre-production process. Here was the story writing process. And oh, my God, you just suck that up. Like and it. Yeah, it's definitely not. It wasn't the case that I was off to the races in that those 6 years were a film school for sure. I shot, I think the initial cut of the movie, if of my first film, if you cut every scene together, a la Zack Snyder, I believe it was, you know, the frame cut, if you will, I believe it was like 2.5 hours or something. And I remember I had a friend who was not a filmmaker. He was an athlete. He was like, he didn't get, you know, but he was willing to sit down and watch the movie with me a few times. And I remember it was, you know, he was a childhood friend and he, you know, we had lost touch for a little while. And he's like, oh, you're making this movie. Let me see it. And then like, we watched it again and we hung out, I don't know, probably 10 or 11 times and cut out an hour of the movie. I mean, an hour of it. That was the first time I had an experience of like, just because you worked hard on it doesn't mean it's staying. You know, I don't think that I would have shot nearly as much bloat if I knew what I was doing, but I had to learn later, like, oh, okay, if you don't know what you're doing when you're shooting, you're going to end up with a really bad movie, you know, and you're going to have to find the story later. Because as they say, post-production is another pass at the script, which I think holds true even for the best films. You know, there's still an opportunity to rewrite. And in some ways, it's more liberating to do it in post because you have a finite number of materials now, whereas on the... If you're sitting in front of a word processor, you can make infinity happen.
Yeah.
But there is something beautiful about like, all right, it's only this much clay and you got to make something with it.
Yeah. Limits are very helpful. I think that that is a really important process that people don't like appreciate. Kids now can like just go on YouTube or like watch Masterclass and be like, oh, well, I know how to, Ron Howard just taught me how to make a film. And you're like, great. Cool.
That's another thing that's kind of been interesting is as I've transitioned into YouTube and stuff, am I a filmmaker still or am I a content creator? What am I precisely?
It depends on who you're talking to and what kind of job you're trying to get.
Yeah, I suppose so. Then again, similar to what I was saying about Stanley Kubrick and the Ramones, I think that sometimes the most valuable advice comes from somebody who is just a little bit ahead of you instead of very, very far ahead of you. Cause again, it's sort of in reach, but no, you're right. There's a lot of, I feel as though it's probably true that young people grow up kind of knowing how to create media in some sense, you know, or at least they have a strong sense of, cause there's a lot of, meta commentary on media too, just everywhere, just at all times. And you had to seek it out when I was young. It was all, here's just the movie. Please leave the supplemental material over there. That's just for geeks. Just to mention the Snyder cut again, I think everybody knows the story behind that at this point, or, you know, a tremendous number of young people know the story. You know, there was a theatrical version and it released in 2017. And now there's this extended cut. It's like, that's all inside. That would have been all inside baseball when I was young.
Yeah, even old lady non-filmmakers like me, for sure, know about that as well. You know, to talk about your YouTube work that you've been working on, I mean, it's a very successful channel. You've clearly figured out not only how to make the videos, but like how to get a lot of attention to it. And, you know, not at all surprised based on the fact that you're like a sponge when it comes to learning how to accomplish, you know, this movie making creation thing. But like, what does it feel like for you? Like you've mentioned, we had just now, you know, we're talking about like, what's the difference between filmmaker and content creator? in reality, it's somebody else's judgment upon you realistically. What do you think you are, and what do you feel like you're creating now? And just to make it a longer question, what are your aspirations for other things you want to make in the future?
Well, I consider myself a filmmaker. I'm the thing that I intended to be. It's even when I'm making unscripted or nonfiction or bloggy type stuff, I'm always applying the filmmaking sensibilities to it. And I backed up into the YouTube thing almost accidentally. It was when YouTube became available, I uploaded an animation that I had done called Lord of the Rings by George Lucas. And it was I just keep bringing up Lord of the Rings. It was this parody. It was making fun of George Lucas because at the time it was kind of fashionable to make fun of him for making the prequels. And it was like, well, what if he took those same bad filmmaking ideas that he applied to the prequels and applied them to Lord of the Rings? That was the joke. And, you know, doing a bunch of impressions and making fun of my betters. And in 2007, that was the number 50th highest viewed video on YouTube. Something, you know, of course, it only ever peaked out at like 2.5 million or something. It was a big hit on YouTube. I remember, you know, it was one of those cool moments where your inbox crashes and all that kind of stuff. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I should upload all my, you know, of course, if I had had a success like that now, I would know to turn it into something, but I was too young and I was making other movies that had nothing to do with that animation. So what I did was I started uploading to that channel, which is the same channel that it is today, or the same account, I suppose. But I started to say, well, okay, well then YouTube is a good repository for wherever, you know, whatever I make, it'll at least be up there, at least be viewable by somebody. And I started doing the thing of, like, you know, behind the scene making ofs of my own films and putting them on YouTube. And that was really how I thought of YouTube. And then when we finished Sexually Frank, I thought, kind of similar to, you know, you talked about podcasting network and sort of aggregating other talent and how can we enable other talent? You know, how can we put creative tools in other people's hands, or how can we take what we've built and give it to other people? I started to kind of get that idea too. Now I was three films deep and I said, well, it'd be really fun to podcast regularly with some, you know, we've got all this equipment hanging around and we're between projects. That'd be cool. So start podcasting. I did one called Discount Film School, which was I'd say similar to conversations like this, where I just seek out everybody in my life that's made something cool or that I feel like I have something to learn from them. And, you've done 60 episodes or so. Most recently I spoke to Freddie Williams who draws for DC. Currently he does Batman versus Ninja Turtles, and fascinating guy. But so started doing podcasting, and then it was out of that, you know, we ended up making another feature, this movie called Having Fun Up There, which I'll only mention to say it was the first thing that I did where I directed and I didn't write. There was somebody who had written a short film that I had read, who I went to school with. We weren't friends, but I really liked this short film. And I was like, I'd like to adapt that into a feature. It was about music. It was about, an aging musician who it's becoming clear to them that this is never going to be their career. And what's going to become of that? The movie's called Having Fun Up There. It comes from, you know, how did you like my set? Well, it really looked like you were having a lot of fun up there, you know, and that's like the only feedback they have. So made that movie, and as a matter of fact, that screened at the Austin Film Festival. And so I got to come out and visit you folks and screen. That was a great experience. I loved coming to Austin. I loved screening at the Austin Film Festival. So I was in this this vibe where I was like, oh, you know, we don't have to just make feature films, and it doesn't just have to be vanity projects for Frankie Frain. It can be, you know, I produced somebody else's short around that time. Just kind of lent them resources, and then, you know, sometime in the middle of all the podcasting, John said, "Hey, I got this like dumb idea. We could probably shoot it on phones, but like, what if we always, the two of us, always loved macaroni and cheese? Like, it works its way into dialogue in all the movies and stuff. It's just this kind of running theme in our lives for some reason." And he said, "What if like this is like 2014. He goes, what if we, you know, he said, I'll shoot it. Maybe I'll even edit it. Cause I up to that point, I was the editor on everything. He said, what if, we just try like a different macaroni and cheese from the supermarket every week. We just see if we can try them all. You know, maybe it's 20 episodes or something. I said, oh, yeah, okay, sure. He said, yeah, yeah, we see each other every Sunday night anyway for dinner. Like, we'll shoot in our, you know, in your kitchen or something. And it'll almost be like a bonus feature of the podcast. That was how we were thinking about it. Well, around that time, another collaborator who's now a part owner of Red Cow, his name is EJ. He was a classmate of mine. I went back to Emerson for grad. I got my MFA there. I was working there too, so it was like a cool tuition benefit thing.
Nice.
He said, you know, I'd really like to collaborate with you guys more. And he was a videographer, a really talented one. He was, he ended up being a cinematographer on a documentary I did right after that called "To Death Do Us Part." It's about how expensive weddings are just crippling to people and don't make any sense to me. is that movie? So we started collaborating more, and he said, yeah, why don't we shoot that box mac thing? Why don't we shoot that macaroni and cheese thing that John had the idea for? I said, okay, yeah, you want to come over? We can all have dinner together. We'll shoot a little dumb thing and we'll be done. But now you have what you just did was you put my wife, who's a producer, and me, who's a filmmaker. I've made 4 feature films. And EJ, who's a cinematographer. And John, he's... all of the equipment is in his house. He's funded a lot of our projects. And we're all in the same space together. And suddenly Box Mac is becoming a film, a film worthy production. it's multicam. Everybody's lavved. The lighting is balanced. Like, we just can't help ourselves but make it kind of good. or at least make the presentation good.
We can't even help it.
We went into it being like, let's make it kind of crappy just so that we don't make too much work for ourselves. And then we made way too much work for ourselves. So as far as the content went, it was just me and John being me and John making macaroni and cheese. And then we got a lot of, like, it reached, I don't know, I think like 1,000 people, which was a lot more than I was used to. And it got a lot of really good feedback. They're like, I would totally watch more of this. This is where I, you know, like, after years of making feature films, people are like, yeah, but this though. and so John, you know, John's a really, really big guy. And he's like, you know, I think I'm willing to exploit myself and dress up like a, you know, a big chef and stuff. It's like, okay, you dress up like a chef. And then we had shirts made up. So now there's Box Mac shirts, and we got about 10 episodes in. And a few now, like a few coworkers were watching. So coworkers are sending in, like, hey, here's a mac and cheese I found from my supermarket. And so people are like sending in mac and cheeses now. So there starts to be this community thing happening with it. And then we came around it hadn't like grown any larger than that, but the Halloween season came upon us, and I had this idea. This is my answer to your question about, like, so, you know, how do you reconcile like YouTube content, film content? Well, here's how. I'm going, wouldn't it be really mind bending if you've been watching this comedy cooking show, and then one episode, it's suddenly a Tales from the Crypt episode. You know, it's 20 minutes of John slowly driving in a car to spooky music, and then sort of this narrative unfolds, and we like, let's make like a big thing, and then eventually we just review mac and cheese anyway. You know, like, what if we did that? So we made basically a Goosebumps episode, or like a Tales from the Crypt episode called Tales from the Craft. There's nice. a puppet in it, and you know, there's a craft keeper puppet in it, and we did the whole thing, and we had an absolute blast, and it was really scratching the creative itch because we were kind of between projects. Then some beautiful soul, I like Francois before him, I don't know who, it's not like a fan who's kept in touch or anything, but somebody was kind enough to post it on Reddit. And Reddit really at that time, and probably still, is where things tend to get a lot of traction.
Yeah.
He posted it and said, like, you know, these two guys making macaroni and cheese is everything. It was some cliche thing like that. And it got a ton of comments, a lot of, fat guys shouldn't eat mac and cheese type of comments. But for every one of those where they didn't stick with the channel because they didn't like how we looked or something, we got this, you know, I don't know, at the time, probably like 1,000 people that stuck with every single episode, and all the views rose on all the past ones. And that inspired us to be like, let's put it out weekly, you know, because we wanted to seize the opportunity. And then John is such an idiosyncratic personality and character. It's not just that he's funny. He's also like, the way I always put it is, he knows he's being funny, but he's not kidding. You know, what he's presenting really is him. So he's like a bargain hunter. So we started this, his name is John Hunt. We call him Junt, which he doesn't even like, but he's now adopted it. It's become like Junt has become a big part of the brand. So we did a show called What's in Junt's Cart, where he, it's just him shopping. It's just him at Stop and Shop telling us about the yellow tags and stuff. And we just find it fascinating. And that turned into going to flea markets and meeting more people. And it was just, our whole world's kind of opened up, because suddenly we were putting out video for a few years. We were putting out a video every Tuesday and every Sunday. Now, this is with full-time jobs, mind you. I didn't have a child yet for a lot of it, but every Halloween and Christmas seasons, we would put out big holiday specials. We were just very, like, we overgave. We were slobberingly grateful to every fan that we had. Started receiving mac and cheeses from Germany, Scotland, Japan. It turned into an unboxing show, because it wasn't just mac and cheese we were getting sent anymore. It was like, we have a fairly notable following in Newfoundland, and they introduced us to this thing called Mummers, which is like this part of the, like, their Christmas celebration. So it became this like weird multicultural thing. Canada, of course, the episode that blew up was Kraft Dinner versus U.S. Kraft. Then there was a few other YouTubers who were really popular. There's one in particular called Bam Lounge that had like over 1 million subs, and they're massive fans of us. They don't miss a video. And they shouted us out on one of their videos, and that attracted an influx of fans. We're still not, you know, we haven't topped 20,000 subs, so we're not a huge channel by any relative metric. But the fact is, there's an audience there. There's somebody who, when we don't, you know, now as of this year, this is the first time in 6 years that I haven't been putting something out every single Sunday. I think I've missed two this year. It was kind of a deal I made with the fans where I was like, listen, I have a child and I have to, it's been 6 years and I'm tired. But yeah, there's people who are like, bummer, there's no Red Cow this Sunday, which, you know, which is very, very meaningful for me. So yeah, we, outside of that wedding documentary, we haven't made a feature film since Having Fun Up There, which came out in 2014. Instead, we've just been making, we're at, I want to say 800 videos since 2015. And to be clear, that's not like, oh, just like a ton of low effort, you know, record and upload. No, like every one of them gets, you know, I don't know, probably a minimum of 4 hours of editing. So a lot of evening time. I had a long commute to Boston for many years until COVID. So that was really dedicated editing time. But man, you spend tens of thousands of hours editing, you're going to become a fast editor, and you're going to learn how to identify what relevant pieces of narratives and stories are. And that, you know, again, even though it's unscripted content, but like, you know, over the course of an unscripted conversation, there are punchlines and there are recurring bits of humor, and the edit is where you really structure that and really make that meaningful, as opposed to tangential or overly spontaneous. So, We people have asked. I've been like, "Do you script it?" You know, it sounds scripted at times. It's like, God no, but it's probably the edit that's making you think that, because the edit sort of formalizes the presentation of the content. So yeah, I've been asked before, like, how could you possibly find the time? Now there are all kinds of time management stuff we could talk about, but I would say the central idea is, I've been editing video for a very long time now, and lots of it, and nothing beats getting good at it and getting fast at it, you know?
I am just overwhelmingly impressed by this situation. And I think it's so funny how you're like downplaying this success. Like, you're like, yeah, it's like not a big deal. It's just like 20,000 people.
No, but it really isn't.
No, listen, I understand that you're not like Imagine Entertainment or whatever. Yeah. Like, I get it. You know, you're not CBS or whatever, but that's not the point. From my point of view of podcasting, I've gone to a number of podcast festivals, and like the constant conversation with everyone is like, stop trying to worry about who's watching you right now or who's listening right now. Create good content, learn how to do what you're doing. If people don't listen to your first five episodes, maybe that's not the worst, okay? Learn how to do it, and then once people start paying attention, whatever. The other thing is, think of how many people you have, and then imagine putting them in a room, and that's a lot of people. Like, your fan base couldn't even be in the same state altogether. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's too many people in one space without 6 feet apart. There's no way they'd make it in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
I like the idea that you're like, oh, yeah, it's not a big deal. But, I mean, to a certain extent, it is. I mean, I would say 1% or 0.5% of filmmakers and creators are making blockbusters or whatever. I mean, like...
Right.
How many people really, really care about what Zack Snyder had to say with that director's cut? But at the same time, because of the famousness, we're like, yeah, do whatever you want. The rest of us are just creatives, and who cares? Like your crowd is so great. I just love this family aspect, not only of creating your stuff, but also like the community that's watching you. Like, you have such a great thing going, and it sounds so exciting and just like so nice to know that there's these people that, like, when you're saying somebody was like, I'm sad there isn't something on Sunday, like, that's awesome. Like,
yeah, it's incredible.
I want someone to be like, oh, I miss this. I love this part of your show. Like, what?
It's definitely an advantage that that the YouTube format has, which is, even if it's a smaller number, it really, at least in the case of our channel, the engagement is incredibly high. We've gotten to know a lot of these people, like, because they comment every week, and you start to know the avatars. And we have these shows, like we have this Box Mac After Hours show where we read a lot of the comments, or we interact, or we do streams where we'll watch like a marathon of all the Halloween shows the night before Halloween. And I become aware of some of their major accomplishments in life or some of their tragedies. It's like they're there for you at that point. They're not there for the macaroni and cheese. It's a common comment where they're like, you know, came for the macaroni and cheese, stayed for the wonderful friendships, or the, you know, whatever. And it all goes back to Cannibal the Musical, where it was like, I was watching this ridiculously stupid movie and seeing through it and going, oh, but I see relationships, and I see fun, and I see excitement. And so that's where we've landed for now. And like I said, my child, who's now three, she's growing up in it. She gets to see dad and his friends make believe, and she gets to make believe a little bit with us. And you know, she really seems to want to be a part of it. I keep hearing her say, like, dad, like, when can we make a movie, you know? And so we're going to, I'm sure that if she remains interested, it's the one thing I can offer her. It's like, well, if you need it edited, my God, I can do it quickly.
Don't worry. You're going to have some amazing school projects.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, man. Oh, hey, thank you so much for talking to me. I just want to ask you one last thing. Like, if there is a young filmmaker coming up now, like, I know that the technologies are different and the environment is different, but with your YouTube experience, like, what do you suggest for them? Like, what do you think they need to do? What would you tell them they don't have to have on their shoulders or worry about that you learned from?
Well, so talking about not being worried about who's watching just yet, you know, we danced with the lights off for a long time, you know, like for a really long time. I've met a lot of people who want to make a movie because they want to have made a movie. Like, the thing that they envision, the thing they fantasize about is when it's all done and how cool it will be to look back on it or to get to watch the movie or get to exhibit the movie. Filmmaking is very, very, very difficult. It's incredibly social. I always forget how difficult it is until I start doing it again. And I'm like, oh my God, yeah, this is like, this becomes nightmarish quickly. Cause at some point you do finish the movie and you forget about it all. It's like what I imagine childbirth is like or something, where you're just like, oh, I'm just left with the cool thing instead of all the difficulty. So my first bit of philosophical advice is you need to embrace the fact that, like, the thing that you need to learn to love and need to learn to enjoy is actually the process of doing it. You need to enjoy the nuts and bolts, because the nuts and bolts can't be in your way. Let's put it that way. The mechanics of the thing can't be an obstacle or be annoying or something. You shouldn't be driven by some, you know, intangible marker of success. I think a marker of success would be that you're out there and you're making good use of your time and you're creating and you're expressing. And if you feel the fire burning, you know, then you know that you're good. And if you kind of don't feel the fire burning, then maybe you're just attracted to the idea of it and not really the actual thing. If the fire is in fact burning, I did this later, but I recommend that people do it maybe up front. When I started podcasting, I realized, you know, unless the person, you know, unless the speakers are particularly polished or can tell stories in a well-structured way or something like that, that an edited podcast is a superior podcast. And just taking audio, forget the video. Take a piece of audio. Let's say you have an hour of audio, people talking or telling a story or something like that. Reducing that down to 10 minutes and making 10 minutes work is a real challenge, but it's a worthy exercise. It's going to get you in the swing of knowing what relevant information is, and how to rhythm, really, because rhythm is so much of why you keep listening to something or why you keep watching something. It's the thing that makes the viewer sit on the edge of their seat, or whatever the audio equivalent of that is. So I recommend experimenting with audio for sure, but in a kind of storytelling, you know, a podcast, I would say. Give that a try before you start intimidating yourself with videography and video editing and all the rest. To use the term from before, the barrier of entry for recording and editing audio is pretty low. Might be a good place to start. And if it's not for you, then video definitely won't be.
yeah.
As far as growing an audience and all that stuff. So, okay, now let's assume that you're confident about what you're making. You know, if I had a massive audience, I'd have really good advice on that. But I think producing regularly, uploading regularly, giving yourself some kind of schedule. If you're really confident in what you're making and you're really excited about what you're making, you're not just doing it to check a box or something like that. It sounds so corny or so fake. I think it will find an audience. I think if you're excited about it, if you're thrilled, if you're like, I can't wait to upload this, or I can't wait to shoot this, it's going to find an audience. There's some, you know, people are attracted to enthusiasm, and there's not a lot of genuine enthusiasm out there. Not as much as you'd think. Again, there's a lot of people attracted to the idea of doing it. It seems really cool to do it, but are they really thrilled about what they're working on? Well, that's hard. That's the hard part. So dance with the lights off. That's my advice. And maybe use the building blocks of audio to get some practice.
Frankie, thank you so much for chatting and sharing with me. It's been really great to talk to you and hear the stories of your adventures and just the different kinds of things that you've learned from and, you know, just the experiences that you've had. You've worked in so many different mediums and essentially as a creator across so many different technologies, like from when you first started on, you know, the computer, the like brand new computer when computers were just invented, to like now where we can do it on our phones. Like your friend's like, yeah, let's just shoot it on our phones. Like the brain exploding of the first child if they heard the second bit is like insane. Like you've done so much and it's so great, and you just really empower me, and I know you're just going to empower filmmakers listening. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I love talking about this stuff. So I really appreciate the awesome line of questioning and the opportunity.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.